One. Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world's changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and it will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you doing, my friend?
Excellent, man. Doing very well.
I was just thinking how amazingly fast our 10 weeks have gone by. We've been doing The World Transformed here since June. We kept talking about it being a 10-week special series, and here we are now on week 10. And it's hard
That's
to
right.
believe it's over.
And we've enjoyed it so much that there's going to be a week 11. So,
exactly.
Yeah, it's still a 10-part series, though.
It's a 10-part series. It's just the last part goes over 2 weeks. So I hope everyone's able to. I wanted to kind of do a thing, you know, from This is Spinal Tap about taking it up to 11, but it's really not an 11th part. This really is we're taking our final discussion, which is our discussion this evening about the subject of acceleration and convergence and human destiny. And we actually had this conversation with John Smart a little bit earlier, and it ran so long that we decided rather than try to stretch our show out longer, we would just run two back-to-back shows this week and next week containing the entire interview.
Well, and the other option would have been to cut down the interview, but it was just too good. And
yeah, I don't know what we would have cut. There's a lot of great stuff in there, and you know, John Smart is, in addition to being one of the leading thinkers in these issues, one of the really prominent voices in talking about accelerating change and in talking about where the world is going. Also, just a good friend, and it was great to have the time just to talk with him, and you know, not worry so much about how long it was taking, but spend some time just kind of getting deeply into these ideas. I think it was time well spent, and hopefully it'll be time well spent for our listening audience as well.
Absolutely.
Well, with that, why don't we, with no further ado, I think let's go right ahead and let's begin our interview with John Smart.
We are very pleased and honored to welcome John Smart to Fast Forward Radio. John is a future scholar and systems theorist who studies science and technological culture with an emphasis on accelerating change, evolutionary development, computational autonomy, and the technological singularity. He's the founder and president of the Acceleration Studies Foundation, which is a nonprofit community that seeks to help individuals better understand and manage continuous accelerating change. He's also been a tremendous influence on me personally and on The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio. John, it's a real pleasure to have you here with us on Fast Forward Radio.
Well, thanks so much, Phil. I really am looking forward to it.
All right. Well, we're going to start off with our standard two questions that we've been springing on everyone throughout the 10 weeks of The World Transformed. And we'll begin with question number one. What is the greatest transformation of our world that you have witnessed in your lifetime?
That's a pretty interesting question. I think gets to the philosophy people have about change. And for me, technology has pretty much been the driver of change in the last few centuries of societies, politics, economics, cultures respond to technology. And so I'd say we have to look at the single most disruptive technology. And for me, that would be the transistor, and also for a lot of other technology scholars that I've read. I think it was January 1st, 1948, we're writing a post quite a while ago saying, you can think of that as Technological Independence Day. It's like 3 days before 4th of July. And basically what happened when it was Shockley and Bardeen and these other guys discovered the transistor, it was just an incredible advance in material science, but more accurately, nanotechnology, in the space of the very small. And we figured out a way to just far more efficiently do this electronic gating than we'd ever done before. And that set in motion another set of accelerations that had been continuing up to that point with things like transistors and electromagnetic relays and then mechanical systems before that. But the transistor just made things in the electronic space so cheap that I think the repercussions of that are really what the second half of the 20th century really is defined by. That you could say that nuclear power was probably equally as important, at least in the political side, but some people have said that 20th century culture is a product of those two things, but if you had to make a choice, I'd say it's primarily the transistor. It's what's enabled all of the electronic culture that we live in today, and the reason why we all talk about realistically about artificial intelligence and what Internet 3.0 is going to look like, and all these amazing things that are happening in wireless and the participatory web. All of that is the bedrock is the transistor, and it's taken almost 60 years of hard work off of that innovation, just simplifying it and figuring out how to take that basic efficiency and do more and more with it.
It's interesting when you choose the transistor, because you think about all the tremendous strides forward that had been made in electronics that led up to that. But that's the one that was able to kind of capture the popular imagination because of its application to consumer electronics, or one of the earliest implementations of that, which would have been the transistor radio. Suddenly there was this proof positive that things could get smaller, that things would work differently, that there was this new, almost, people looked at it as almost as magical new technology showing up.
I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I remember getting my dad's transistor radio, and, it was the first really cool piece of technology I got, and so small, and it just changed your way of thinking about technology. I think that the computer revolution, which, again, I was in the early Mac days and the early PC, again, and then with cell phones, ATMs, about everything that we think has kind of disrupted our own cultures in our own lifetimes, it all comes directly out of that. And there's a great DVD called Transistorized, like Ara Flatow is the narrator, if I recall correctly, and I recommend it if you really want to get the essence of how the huge technology boost that pushed the 21st century to a whole new level of complexity. It's hard to beat that one.
I'm reminded of moving the radio from a piece of furniture to something to put in your pocket kind of mirrors what happened with mainframes being put on people's desktops and now in their briefcases with integrated circuits later. So, yeah, very cool.
So let's follow that up then with the second part of the World Transform questions, which is, what's the greatest transformation of our world that you expect to witness in your lifetime?
I wrote an article on the web in 2003, and I was lucky enough to get a lot of people linking to it. And if you Google it now and hit "I'm feeling lucky," it's still the top link on the web about this transition that I think is the biggest one we're going to see. And I call it the conversational interface, and that's just a term that various people have been using for a natural language processing system that it allows you to speak to it in English language sentences and complex grammars, and that will speak back to you in complex grammars, or I'll show you words or numbers or pictures appropriately. And the conversational interface is based on something called natural language processing. And the last 5 years or so, Google has made some just tremendous strides in statistical natural language processing. And that's basically the association of words that are commonly used together on the web. And because there is so much of everything we say on the web now, and it's being indexed and added, that corpus is growing so fast. And as the amount of words that you and I use, both our vocabulary, sophisticated vocabulary, typically tops out at 100,000 words, the number of questions that we ask, it is relatively slow growing relative to the indexing of all the information. So there's a term in physics called ergodicity, and that's the idea that the kind of phase space of all the important events in a system is fixed It's effectively fixed. It may be growing, but it's growing very slowly relative to the map. And if your map's growing fast and the phase space of important events is growing slowly, eventually you get a tipping point. You reach a point where pretty much you have a rough map of all the important things that are in that space. And so in 2003, I wrote this article saying, you know, I think it's going to happen. It's going to happen in our lifetime, and it's going to be the single greatest thing we're going to see in our lifetime, because everything else is going to look small by comparison afterwards, because any kid being able to talk to the Oracle, in this case Google or Yahoo or whatever, and learn as fast as their curiosity drives them just by talking, well, that kid from that point forward is not going to consider themselves just a creature of their own local culture. They're going to consider themselves kind of a planetary citizen, and they're going to consider the Oracle the best single educational source, far better than any kind of education they've ever had before. And so, you know, 15, 18 years later, those kids growing up, they're going to have a completely different set of values, a completely different set of political priorities. I believe the amount of warfare and pettiness that we're going to have is just going to be so significantly reduced. I shouldn't say pettiness, actually. I should say warfare. I should say the major conflict and the levels of dogma that we bring to those conflicts. I think we're going to see permanent changes in that. And the primary thing that's needed is a system that you can talk to that will be able to talk back to you for anything complex, your car, your house, your computer, your software that you're using, your robo-kitchen, whatever it is. You don't need to figure out how to use it as long as there's something you can talk to that will teach you how to use it. And Google's search query length is growing, it's doubling every 7 years. And so I updated my article in 2005 with some data that said in 1998, you and I...
I'm sorry, you said the search query length, the actual number of words that people put into the query?
That's right, the average number of words. Yeah.
Okay.
In 1998, you and I were using AltaVista, if you remember that.
Oh, yeah.
An average of 1.3 words. And by 2005, we were using 2.6. We doubled in a seven-year period. And so in 2005, and by then we were using Google and PageRank, right? And so I basically updated in 05 with this basically an S-curve, which the first half of any S-curve is an exponential, and then it reaches an inflection point. And I argued the inflection point for query length doubling is going to happen somewhere around 10 words, because for a complex question you and I ask each other, the average word length is about 8 to 11 words. So you're going to ask an oracle that's going to be able to give you intelligent information at least a question as long as 8 to 11 words, if it's going to give you intelligent information back. And so I expect this doubling to continue from 2.6 to 5.4 in 2012, and from 5.4 to 10.2 in 2019. And somewhere between 2012 and 2019, 5.2 and 10.4 average words that you and I ask our most complex search engines for our, you know, when we want to understand things, you're going to get emergent grammars that are going to come out. And that system's going to have kind of a pidgin English. And you're going to feel like it's smart. It's not going to be smart. It's not going to have any significant model of who you are, at least in the early stages. But it's going to be like a super smart butler, kind of like what Ask Jeeves was always supposed to be, but, you know,
right,
never could, because it didn't have the intelligence behind it. So once it has the NLP, the natural language processing, intelligent, then you're going to see a phase change, and the ease of doing things, all kinds of things, is going to go through a permanent flip. And the level of unity that people have in terms of being connected to each other through this connective tissue of electronics, of intelligent electronics, is going to be permanently different. And so I've had a bunch of people email me since and think it's an interesting idea. And Google, our average query length on Google is now north of 4 words as of, I think, 2-3 months ago.
Interesting.
And, of course, we go significantly, so it's well on the path, 5.2 by 2012. And for technical things, Google's very deep, right? I mean, you'd never use Microsoft help again, right? I mean, you're just going to ask the Oracle a nice complex question about how to do something with Windows, for example. And, you know, some cool geek out there has got a nice little, you know, solution that's maybe 2-3 links down that's what you're looking for. And so you see people being teased into using longer and longer queries. You know, Google learned the operator near a couple of years ago. Coffee shops have near Palo Alto, right? I mean, that's 5 words. And with your GPS and your phone, there's just more and more context that the system can use that, again, teases us into using longer and longer sentences. And there will come a point where it'll tap out, where you won't want to ask a 24-word or a 15-word question because it takes a long time, but you will for certain things that are complex searches. You're going to definitely throw those extra words on because if they give you the benefit, I mean, the cost is pretty low. And so I really expect people to be impressed with, we might call this intelligence amplification, IA, to use Werner Vinge's term, rather than artificial intelligence, AI. But it's a level of IA with a little AI that is completely new. And I think we're actually on the cusp of it now, and we're going to see it. It's going to be clear to people who want to look close easily by 2012. I mean, today you and I can use Voice app for iPhone, if you've ever seen that. And it's Google's new tool for voice recognition and natural language processing for queries on the phone. And they do server-side processing for the voice rec and also for the NLP. And the NLP has 3 trillion unique word combinations, they call them tokens, that they use to create that NLP map. And of course, it's not a closed map. I mean, there's a whole bunch of questions that people haven't asked the web that aren't already up there yet. But statistically, that amount of unasked questions shrinks every year. So you get to a point where your question, and it's probably going to be within the next 10, you know, maybe a little more than 10 years, just about any question you can ask, somebody's asked something similar.
Right.
It's out there, and now you've got a map, and all you're doing is you're making the details of them. It's like having the first useful world map. The details go up from that point forward, but the map doesn't really change much, and that's a fascinating new world, because now all kinds of new services can get built on top of that map, and you're no longer competing to make the map, you're competing to make top of the map.
Go ahead, Stephen, I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask John about a potential roadblock to this future or other futures that we think about. You know, Gordon Moore's idea that we're able to put more and more transistors in an integrated chip, he said back in 2007 that maybe we got another 10 years of being able to continue to do more and more of that. And then I learned from the Boulder's Future Salon mailing list that they were talking about semiconductor manufacturing tools are becoming too expensive to depreciate with volume production over their lifetimes, and their costs are going to be so high that around 2014 they will max out. So whether it's 2014 or 2017, it looks to me like there's sort of to the end of Moore's law. I mean, at that point, does Accelerating Studies Foundation close up? Does Fast Forward Radio become a sports talk program? Or what do we do at that point?
Well, yeah, this is a fascinating question, Stephen, and you're getting to, I think, probably the first of the three big topics we're supposed to talk about today, which was acceleration, convergence, and human destiny. And in this question of acceleration, how long does it go? When does it stop? And does it turn into something else? Is pretty foundational. And I would say if we want to think about this particular one, trends always end, right? Remember we talked about, I didn't say that we plot this growth of conversational intelligence, the conversational interface article. I didn't say that we plot that on an exponential curve. We plot it on an S curve.
Yeah.
Because everything tops out. So there's clearly going to be a topping out of integrated circuits being shrunk using this standard lithography technique, the smaller and smaller feature size, and it has to top out. And it was originally thought to top out because of the quantum interference, you know, with these tiny, tiny feature sizes somewhere in the 2020s, and now you're pointing out that it might be 2015s or even earlier because of what's called Rock's Law. Arthur Rock said that the price of a chip fab plant doubles every time you're, it was at 2.5, it was even worse than doubling, every time you get doubling in transistor density. And so there's, you know, obviously some point where the global world product cannot, the global world economy can't support that increased chip fab cost. And Gordon Moore talked about it. He said that no business has ever had more than 1% of gross world product, and computer industry is heading very quickly towards 1% of GWP, and he couldn't see it continuing to double more than another 10 or 15 years. And I think he said that in 1999 in a beautiful book called Visions of Technology by Richard Rhodes, a Pulitzer Prize winner, and he was trying to project out, you know, the next 50 years of computers. And So yes, it has to be a saturation. They have to hit the top of an S-curve. But you know, as Kurzweil and others, other technology scholars have said, scientific innovation is just a history of escalating S-curves. And the new technology that comes out is always in order to overtake the old one, it's got to be more space, time, energy, and matter efficient, STEM efficient, you might call it. That's the term that I use. Has to use resources, physical resources, much better to do more better with less, as Buckminster Fuller would call it. He called it ephemeralization. And so the fundamental question is, does material science, does the research physics, the nanotechnology that we look at, does it support the idea that there's going to be something that's going to come along that is significantly more space, time, energy, and matter efficient than what we're using today? And if so, then only when you reach saturation in the old technology can you have economic conditions that will allow the new one to emerge. So I'll give you an example. I think it was 1984 that a technologist and visionary called Danny Hillis created something called the Connection Machine, and it was a parallel computer that had, I believe, 64,000 processors. Now, it was a very cool early version of what you could do with parallel systems, but by the time it was built, of course, it was obsolete because chips were in their magic shrinking game. And if chips are in their magic shrinking game until, let's say, I believe you said 2015, let's say it's been, until 2015, then you can't build massively parallel systems. You're going to economically bankrupt yourself to try and create any kind of a massively parallel, biologically similar architecture. Now, that isn't technically true because we have discovered, folks like NVIDIA, graphics processing unit, GPU chip manufacturers, have discovered in the last 10 years that you can actually massively parallelize very simple algorithms for parallelizing, can do rendering of video game and CGI for movies. And so you have these huge render farms that use simple parallelism, and you know it's made a huge amount of money for all of the GPU companies to use these algorithms. And of course, we have simple parallelism in our new Core processor in the PS3 and less so in the Xbox 360. But it's hard to write parallel processing programs, and no one's going to write them. No one's going to try and write them for general things. There's no economics for it, for even doing the experiments, until you hit saturation with the previous regime. And so I would argue you can't get a world where you have city block-sized computers that are massively parallel FPGAs or some other reconfigurable core that are highly biologically inspired. Maybe you've scanned some human brains and or other mammalian brains, and you've got architectures like that sitting in there, and you've got flocks of grad students playing with this thing, looking for interesting emergence to see what kind of pattern recognition this thing can do. You can't make a thing like that until you get to that post-2015 world. But in that world, you can. Now you have the economics that will allow a new kind of acceleration. So let's call that horizontal acceleration or parallelism acceleration. Again, there's another doubling curve, right? The number of tunnel boring machines that are on the planet today are on a Moore's Law curve. They're doubling every 3 years. And that's why I argued, I think 5 years ago, I wrote this paper about how we could, in high-density cities, we could just dig tunnels from point to point between everything important in the city. We can put all the parking garages underground. And so that's based on the convergence of tunnel boring machines, automated highway systems, and zero-emission vehicles, you know, electrics and such. And so everything really is on this kind of Moore's Law curve. There will come a time when it's actually affordable for the most richest cities to actually put a bunch of their infrastructure, their critical transportation infrastructure, underground. And you won't care about it because you're driving in an automated car and you're watching stuff on the screens on the inside of your car anyway. But you can't get a thing like that. You know, it's kind of like a video phone. You can't get it until you have a whole lot of interesting complexity. It won't happen. You know, the video phone is one of those flying car futures. Everyone said, oh, yeah, it's going to happen right away. You know, AT&T put a lot of money into it. The reality was being chained to sitting down looking at a video is actually less fun than what we're doing right now. I'm walking around the room with a wireless handset. And if I don't have spatial audio and video in my house, so if I'm talking to Granny, I want to see her image move with me through the house, If I'm sitting down on the John, I want the video feed to stop. You know, if I don't have all if I don't have all that automation built into my video phone, it's not going to be a necessary device, right? So the level of consumer adoption, the threshold for convergence is high for a lot of these things. And the threshold for moving into this biologically inspired, significantly more parallelized computing regime, where the acceleration is now horizontal rather than in miniaturization. The miniaturization is actually now miniaturization of highly parallel systems. That's the new counting we would do in this scenario I've painted. And by the way, it could go differently from what I've said, of course. I'm just giving one scenario for how the acceleration might continue. The deeper question, though, to really tie this off, is we have to ask ourselves, is accelerating change something that seems fundamental to human culture? And if it's fundamental to human culture, can we see it in all human biology as well, as far back as we go? If it's fundamental to all biology, 4.5 billion years back, do we see it in the universe as well? And so our organization has found scholars who say, yes, we see acceleration as far back as the first primitive galaxies. From that point forward, a few billion years into the universe's lifespan, we actually see accelerating change. We see the emergence of complexity faster and faster in more and more localized spaces. And what is that? Well, we don't really know. I mean, we have to give ourselves permission to ask that question first.
My next question was going to be whether the acceleration that we observe is a byproduct of human activity. We have a concept we talk about at the Speculist on Fast Forward Radio we call the human imperative, and that's this idea that humans are essentially reconfigurers of the universe and that we're always looking for the optimum configuration. So we continue making these changes. We go from building stone tools to building skyscrapers, or from passing history intergenerationally around the campfire to updating our Facebook profiles. And that in this process, we have this compounding of benefits which has occurred, and that enables each new reconfiguration to come faster than any that came before. And so my question would have been, I think you've already answered it, but is that just because humans are the way they are, or is it something that goes deeper? Now, if it is something that goes deeper, do we have any? Are we just at the stage of asking that question, or do we have any thoughts as to how this acceleration might be built into the fabric of the universe, as it were?
I think we do. I think it's both. I think we have some thoughts, but we're also just at the stage of asking the question seriously. I mean, if you look at it from a century-type scale, and, you know, futurists love to do that. They love to zoom out and look at the bigger picture, and, boy, a lot of things become simple. Not everything, but a lot of things really become clear. And if you look at it on the scale of the last few decades, well, yes, we're just giving ourselves permission to ask that question. I mean, you remember Bernard Vinge's Technological Singularity essay, it was at 84. You know, it got so much notoriety on the emerging web because it was the first to really eloquently and simply state this point that this acceleration seems to be leading to some kind of a convergence and a threshold. And it's going to happen soon. And it's going to be human surpassing in, not just the simple ways where your calculator is a human surpassing singularity to you, right? I mean, it's able to do and never will be able to do in the biological space. But even in the higher human functions, so higher and higher levels of singularities, chains of singularities, where the machine intelligence kind of reaches a point that it permanently takes over a certain module of physical transformation or computation that humans used to do but no longer do. So, yeah, why? Why does this happen? Well, there are definitely some ideas for it, and I'm going to get to them more in the destiny side of things, of this conversation we're having. But
fair enough.
Just to give you a kind of simple intro to it, in biology, there's two fundamental processes of change, evolution and development, and they're kind of orthogonal to each other. They do different things for different purposes. And so those two words are beautiful words, evolution and development. And, you know, in the United States, you and I, all growing up, we learned about the theory of evolution, and we probably didn't get too much on development unless we took a developmental biology class in college, which many of us didn't do. But evolution is something that's kind of like hold your left hand up in front of you and look at it. It is kind of like a tree that radiates out. It's constantly experimenting. It's creating more variation over time. It's also creating more functional specialization amongst the variations. So evolution is really all about creativity and change and variety, right? And if you hold your right hand out and look at it in front of you, you see all those fingers kind of coming together at your wrist. And it's kind of like all roads leading to Rome. And that's what development is. Development is, you might call it convergent unification rather than variation. Because developmental processes have to take this initial seed and they have to unfold the biological seed into the organism, and they do it through a variety of stages that takes all this molecular chaos and convergently unifies to create all these new hierarchies, like, let's say, the body plan, or then the organ systems, or then a mature brain, or then a reproductive system that now is physiologically mature 13 years after the human has been born. And now that reproductive system has the capacity to create a new version of that organism in a developmental cycle. So development has hierarchy, and it has life cycle in it, and it has future-specific emergent order tuned into the system. So it has directionality to it, right? Well, evolution has some directionality, but if you remember holding your left hand out in front of you, the main directionality is just increased diversity. Increased variation is what Stephen Jay Gould called it. He said, that's the only major signature you can say about evolution is it's always creating more variation. But development doesn't do that. Development cycles, and development has these hierarchies that emerge. And so now if we say, well, we want to understand accelerating change in the universe writ large, I would ask you, well, does that look like an evolutionary signature, or does that look like a developmental signature?
It looks like a developmental signature. If you talk about this series of S-curves, you're talking about things tending to repeat. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think you're talking about a pattern, a particular direction of hierarchies. These series of S-curves kind of create hierarchies of complexity that build on top of each other. And in most cases, the old ones don't go away when the new one emerges, right? The bacteria didn't disappear when metazoans emerged, right?
Mm.
It does look like something hierarchical. And evolution, you know, we have to remember with evolution, we have these branching, these increasing branches, but there's no directionality to it. As Gould and others, you know, Dawkins eloquently point out, the new niche that could be exploited could be a cave with no light, and now you're going to lose your eyesight. Or maybe you're going to hang on to the bottom of a shark, and you're going to lose most of your higher organ system function. You're going to become a remora, a parasite, right? So there's no particular directionality towards increased complexity in evolution. And yet, when we look at the history, 4.5 billion years of Earth's history, and then when we look at the processes in the universe at large that led to complex Earth-like planets like ours, which we don't know, but we suspect are ubiquitous in the universe, and we're going to discover that within our lifespan, too. And that's one of the other really amazing things that we can look forward to in the next few decades. If Earth-like planets, Earth-type planets, and are as ubiquitous as M-class stars, the kinds of suns that our planet is around, which we already know is ubiquitous, it's the most common type, then we're going to say that there seems to be tuned into the basic physics of the universe, of this particular universe, the emergence of this hierarchical complexity in an accelerating signature, increasingly fast in these special places, you know, these places that support carbon chemistry, and then all of the interesting things that can be done with complex organic chemistry that turns into cells and the things that we build on top of cells. So yes, it does look to me, to a first approximation, like it's developmental. And if it is developmental, then there's probably replication built into it. And that is actually a very fortuitous thing, because if you remember your physics, 150 years ago, we learned about the second law of thermodynamics. And all the philosophers had to confront this idea of heat death, that our entire universe looks to be as finite a system as every other complex system in our universe. So it's going to die too. And now we have dark energy as of 1998, which is telling us that there's this special force, fifth force in the universe, or it's not a force, it's a property of space-time that allows that basically accelerates all space apart from space. And that tells us that not just hundreds of billions of years in the future are we going to run out of energy in our universe, but actually within just tens of billions of years, you're going to look up at the night sky and you're going to see nothing. Because everything interesting is being pushed apart from everything else that's interesting based on this negative pressure property of space. So it looks like, to a first approximation, to a high school kid, it looks like the universe has taken itself apart into these special subsets. And that also is something that living systems do. They all recycle themselves. And so if it looks like our universe is actually going to have decreased complexity, except in these islands of emergent order, and this decrease in complexity is accelerating now, well, then there better be some kind of way of perpetuating that. And if one is actually built into the physics of the universe, well, that's pretty interesting. And everything I've just said to you is speculation. And it's a hypothesis. It's actually a hypothesis with very early tentative evidence. And I've written an article on it called Evo Devo Universe, and I think we'll get to that in the last part of our interview.
You're listening to Fast Forward Radio. We're talking with futurist John Smart about the forces that are transforming our world, technological acceleration and technological convergence. John, I hear what you're saying about development, and Phil as well. There's just a lot in our current world that leaves me a little disappointed as far as, in other words, it seems like in some ways our own leadership is not ready for the future. I mean, whether it comes to their solutions for healthcare, economy, environment, whether you're talking about people on the left side of the aisle or the right side of the aisle, all of our solutions seem to be static and based on linear projection. So I guess my question is, do our plans for the future get in the way of the future coming about?
Well, that's a beautiful question, and I think they do, you know, almost all the time. Kurzweil likes to talk about how we have a linear view of the future in an exponential world, and that's a very valid and helpful way of looking at it. Another way that I think is really helpful is that we take a very evolutionary approach in the developmental world. If we live in an evolutionary developmental world, and that phrase, by the way, whenever you hear someone use that phrase, evolutionary developmental, it's a phrase that basically says, look, I don't really know whether evolution or development is the key process happening here, but they're both apparently happening. And that's the kind of world we're in. We have an evolutionary world and we have a developmental one. And like we said, you know, with evolution, it doesn't know what's going to work. It just throws things at the wall and sees what sticks. I think that is a part of what we do, is there's going to be a lot of kind of random change, a lot of very contingent, stochastic, messy stuff on our way to constructing this next level of hierarchy. It's what James Crutchfield at Santa Fe Institute called search basins and portal pathways. Basically, you've got this search basin with all these marbles just randomly mucking about, bumping around, and then they find these portal pathways, and these are basically holes in the bottom of the basin, and very few of them. And all the marbles eventually have to go through those holes. That's the developmental transition. But the path they take, the evolutionary path, can be completely unpredictable, messy, and in a lot of places it's going to be, you know, two steps backward, three steps forward. It's really not going to look like progress, particularly on a fine-grained scale. And I know, to get to your other question of, you know, can we improve that? Can we get people that are more aware, that are more looking for the developmental signature, so there's going to kind of advance the dialogue, so to speak? I believe we can. So, you know, part of the things I'd like to talk about later on in the convergence section is, what are some of the things that inevitably look like they're in the future? And if this conversational interface is inevitably in the future, I want you to imagine how different our world would be if we recognized that and we all decided to do, you know, a 10-year sprint to the CI the way that Kennedy did a 10-year sprint to the moon. Or a 10-year sprint to real broadband like Korea and Japan have. If we actually, in this country, recognized just how much productivity emerges once everybody has real broadband. You know, in Korea, you can buy 24% of the groceries that are bought in Korea, the recent stat I saw. Actually, it was an older stat, are bought online, and that's because they have such incredible broadband. I think it's 30, 40 times ours, right? And here we have, you know, companies like Webvan and Peapod that start up, and you know, most of them go bankrupt shortly after they start up because there isn't even enough broadband for people to use the web like it's their, you know, an extension of their self. It's an obvious developmental future, And if we created it, we would have a far richer, more productive society. And yet, we're stuck in the old kind of economic model that, these things, leave them to the market. Well, there's a whole lot of things that you can accelerate with good regulation, with good leadership. And there's a whole lot of things that are more fundamental public goods than private goods. And next time you get on a highway, you can, particularly in the East Coast, you can thank your stars that it's a public good, because before that, everything was turnpikes. I mean, that's where the turnpike word comes from, right? It was a bunch of private roads, and you had to turn the pike at the end of the road to lift it to get through to the next private road. And that was so ridiculously inefficient, all privately funded. It was a great first phase, but then the government recognized just how much acceleration could come. Now, imagine if we had the same thing in our broadband. If we had, you had guarantee of fiber to the home, government had eminent domain, it could make sure everyone gets it, and that this is a publicly regulated utility, and all the private stuff happens on top of it. But, oh my God, man, it's been 10 years now that everyone could have 60 times more broadband than you and I have. And likewise with the wireless spectrum. Google has a patent on a auctioning device for wireless spectrum so that you and I can open our cell phone, and our cell phone is smart enough now to find all the providers that provide cell phone coverage in that space, and then we go with the lowest priced carrier. Now, there's all kinds of laws in place by the oligopolies to make sure that patent can't even be executed right now. But imagine if we had leadership to say, oh my God, man, everybody should have that as a right. Think how quickly you and I would have incredibly cheap, totally pervasive 3G wireless, and then what that would do for our wearable augmented reality systems that are plugged into, the global intelligence that is the web. And not just us, but every kid in the world needs access to that, and they need that kind of leadership. And it has to flow, I think, from this recognition that certain things on the horizon are totally developmental, and they're totally what Bob Wright would call non-zero positive sum. There's people going to be hurt, but the people that are hurt are so in the minority by comparison to all the people that are going to be helped. I mean, yes, you have to get these big communication monopolies to roll over. You're not taking away their lunch. You're just taking away, their breakfast. But then what you get from that is a whole new ecology that's so much more productive. There's so much more GWP in the whole system. The size of the pie goes up so much. Their fraction goes down, but their absolute amount will go up. That's the non-zero-sum idea.
Okay, well, I love this image of the information superhighway following the interstate highway model in terms of deployment. Let's stay with the idea of convergence, and I'm going to throw a true or false question at you. True or false, millions of years of human evolution and ultimately the full 15 billion year history of the universe all led up to the introduction of the iPhone. Okay. Right. The iPhone is the symbol for our age, it seems to me, and it's the symbol for the age of convergence because it brings everything together. Right. You got hardware and software together. You got computation and communication together. You got work and play. It's all there. It's all together. So, tell me how the iPhone portends bigger, even more amazing convergences to come. What's going to happen next in an iPhone world?
Well, we talked about the conversational interface earlier. I think that's the primary thing. We talked about, or you've heard of one laptop per child. I think that was a noble metaphor, but it got the interface wrong. The device is going to be one cell phone per child. And this iPhone is an incredibly powerful tool that's just going to keep getting more powerful. And we want to make sure every kid gets that. And Google's going to make sure, and so is all the other search companies that have anything to say in it, they're going to make sure that kids get these things for free. They may even pay them to get them because they're going to sell location-based ads on the side while kids are doing these searches. And that world is a very different world. A kid who grows up with that kind of processing power in their hand and that kind of conversational intelligence built into the system. And, you and I use Yelp today, which is just the beginning of a tipping point of a participatory web where your vote matters, not just your vote in the democracies that the political centralized political systems have allowed you, but your vote in terms of what you do with your behavior and your money, what you spend your time and your energy on, right, and your money. And that vote's going to be increasingly informed by these intelligent systems. And when you don't get the kind of service you want, you're going to jump on Yelp and all of its successes and make sure other people know that. I'm not going to go see a movie that I don't... I go to IMDb and make sure there's at least a few thousand people that have rated a movie above 6.5, or I won't even bother to see it. So I have completely cut out a whole bunch of low-quality crap because of that, and I totally rely on that intelligence. You know, in the future, I'm going to be able to do subsorts where the people who have my values that have publicly expressed them, those are the people that I use to, their ratings are the ones I use to guide my purchases and my responses. And so basically, you know, what we're talking about here is an evolutionary process, a process of increasing variation, increasing cultural diversity, increasing ability to find subcultures that think like you and that promote your values. And yes, there's a possibility, increasing possibility, to create echo chambers where you go into your own little cocoon and you no longer listen to the outside world. But as we've discovered in the past, whenever that happens, there's a huge cost, adaptive cost, and cultures that do that become quickly irrelevant. But the cultures that are the most vibrant are the ones that protect their own unique way of looking at things, but then they stay completely, what we call semi-permeable to the outside world. They're always following what's going on in the outside world. They're always taking the best of it and interpreting it for their own culture. And so I think that's, you know, there's a lot of evidence that cultures can do that. And even though we live in a world where languages are dying like crazy because we're centralizing our languages and our currencies also, at the same time, we're seeing more subcultures than ever before existed. And we're just at the tip of seeing that. You know, we saw the start of that in the 60s, and, you know, people have experimented with different types of intentional communities since the Enlightenment. But we're seeing more and more of those kinds of communities, I think, in a very rich world where the cost of doing it goes down, and the community might just be you and a bunch of your friends living close to each other in a particular neighborhood. And, you know, Sedona gets more New Agey, Castro gets more gay, and all of these places more easily support their own ways of existence. They have lobbies behind them. And that's what subcultures don't have today. They don't have those kind of lobbies. But in this iPhone-enabled world, we're going to see a whole lot more diversity of subculture in every case where it's a non-zero-sum thing, where the variety doesn't cost the rest of us. It is either neutral or it adds interesting complexity to the system. And that feels to me like, and of course I'm being very optimistic, and I'm glossing over all the difficulties to the first generation versions of these technologies, and there's huge numbers of them, right? First time any of these technologies come into a space, a human space, they dehumanize us, they disrupt us, they put a bunch of us out of work. But second generation, a little better, and by the third generation, you find these net humanizing. We've figured out the rules and the codes of these systems. We fine-grained them. And now they are adding benefit. And if they aren't, by then, we legislate them out of existence. And a perfect example is nuclear power. I mean, what a better example could you have that we don't live in a technologically deterministic world, right? We take a technology, and if we like it, we keep it. And if it's got too many downsides to it, we keep it to a minimum backup, like 15% of the power like we do here in the U.S., just in case everything else goes to crap, right? And we basically regulate it to into trivialness, and we keep it there, and probably for good reason, because the nuclear proliferation issue is so huge and so unsolved that until we get to that issue, until we get to a world that's far safer, and the possibility of nuclear proliferation doesn't scare us anymore, do we then let that genie out of the bottle? So I think we have incredible ability to regulate things. I'm just going to give you one more example of how you can regulate something, how it may be inevitable, like nuclear power is inevitable, maybe developmental, but the evolutionary choice that a culture makes is completely different from culture to culture. And the gun is a perfect example. I mean, you could say once guns exist, well, sure, every government has to have them. They have to keep them as the backup, at least, in case they're needed. You know, the security systems are going to have them. The fundamental legitimation of the state is its ability to use force. So they're developmental. They're going to exist everywhere. But look what happened in Japan. In Japan, the guns came, I think, in the 1600s from the Portuguese. It's called a palenque. Jared Diamond, Guns, Germs, and Steel, has a nice account of this. They, within, I think, 50 or 70 years, they had the best guns in the world. Of course, Japanese being the kind of culture they are, constantly taking something and improving it. And then the Tokugawa clan looks at it and says, you know, this doesn't fit with our samurai culture. And they ban guns. They increasingly restrictive laws, and guns basically disappear over the next 50 years. They don't come back for another 200 plus years, just because the culture decides that they were too disruptive. And that's a beautiful example of cultural regulation. And now if you go to, you know, Japan, something like 150,000 people have registered guns, and you know, it's something like 30-50 million in the United States. And they have a shooting rampage, and in Japan a shooting rampage is two deaths and four people wounded. And they spot check all 150,000 of those registrations, and they pull 3% of them because they decide those people were too financially or emotionally, whatever, unstable, and they have to reapply if they want to get them again next year.
Well, you know what's interesting when you use Japan as the example, John, is that, great, so Japan decided against guns, U.S. decided in favor of guns, U.S. decided against nuclear power. Japan uses nuclear power almost exclusively, isn't that right? That's their big source of power. So it just goes to show you that that the different cultures really do make different choices.
It absolutely does. And the French would probably be the best example. I think they're 80-some-odd% for nuclear power. But I think only in cultures like Japan and France that are what we'd call demilitarized does that even make logical sense. Now we're getting to fine-grained issues where we can just agree on everything. But basically the point is that the major issue, which is the nuclear proliferation issue, was the one that never got solved. I mean, sure, you have the nuclear waste issue, but that's very secondary to the proliferation issue. And so because of that, only a few cultures do they have the environment where they're so post-military that there's not even going to be an issue that they might use it in that way. But even in the case of France, where they went to 80% nuclear power, I would argue that was very destabilizing for the world. It was one of the poorest choices for energy that has ever been done, because their culture, they licensed that technology to so many shady third world countries that now Pakistan and these other countries are on the verge of nuclear weapons. And they shouldn't be, but they are. And they are because we basically had a couple of rogue countries, well, one rogue country in particular, France, that was way too loose in its technology proliferation, when it's completely obvious that any kid is going to be able to build a nuclear bomb in their basement at some point in the future. And so the question has to be, well, if that's developmental, just like guns are developmental, the question is, how do we create a world where the ability for any kid to build a nuclear bomb in their basement, let's say it's 100 years from now, doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because we have immune systems that are so fine-grained that we can make sure that doesn't happen. Statistically, it doesn't happen. If it does, it's so rare that it doesn't destabilize us. And now we're getting to another developmental issue, which is transparency. You know, we are in a world of accelerating transparency in the public space, and we have accelerating sensors going in everywhere, and you know what Teilhard de Chardin called immune systems. Basically, we're creating an integrated planet where there's going to be trusted immune systems that can go everywhere. We don't have those trusted immune systems today. We're just beginning to work out those kinds of multinational transnational agreements, and maybe more importantly, those trusted immune systems are going to be largely AI. They may not even be human. But I think the big point is those things, we can see those things have to come in order to have stability. So if we see that, why accelerate the development of a highly unstable, highly destabilizing technology when we see things like solar, hydrogen fuel cells and such that are on their own Moore's Law improvement curve, and we can actually extrapolate out when they're going to become cheaper than coal and get us out of the fossil fuel environment. So if we can already see those coming in the next few decades, why would we, you know, make the evolutionary choice to go with an easy solution like nuclear when it has all these proliferation downsides? And I would say we would make that choice because we didn't have enough foresight. So, again, my argument would be the French, now I'm not talking about the Japanese, the French didn't have enough foresight when they did that. Now, the Japanese very significantly scaled back nuclear, just like we did after Tokaimura. Now, I remember there was three accidents, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, and Tokaimura, all within a short period of time. And from that point forward, all of those countries scaled back in their nuclear. So we learn from our catastrophes. We realize that, hey, you know, these things are a little more complex than we thought. And so I think the rates at which we develop various technologies are, again, really important moral choices that we make. And we have to make them, I think, in this calculation of what things do we see that are coming that are really going to be good, that we really expect are pretty inevitable, the developmental things. And what things are the experiments, the evolutionary choices we want to make? We have no idea whether they're going to work out or not, but we want to make sure we have a whole bunch of those experiments going on too at the same time, as long as the cost of them isn't too great. So it sounds like to me like we've gotten to some pretty good issues here where we could probably talk forever about what is the right choice in terms of leadership. At least I've stated my point, and I'd love to hear yours.
Well, you know, what's interesting is we have Brian Wong on the show frequently, and he's looked into and talked a good deal about increasing safety in nuclear energy. But I think the whole discussion becomes moot based on Ray Kurzweil, who was on last week, who said that basically 100% of our energy, we can have it from solar within 20 years. I don't think we'll make that kind of progress with nuclear. I think solar will win the race just based on easy, clean, safe, fewer downsides, and if the technology is there, that's what we're likely to go with. But let's stick with our discussion of convergence.
Don't knock hydrogen fuel cells out of the race either. I mean, we talk about new nanotechnology, right? I think it was just last month these guys in Quebec came up with a iron-based hydrogen, an iron-based catalyst that sits inside of a buckyball that is 35 times better than previous non-precious metal catalysts for doing electrolysis in a fuel cell. And so this thing is within 10% of the efficiency of the platinum and palladium catalysts that are currently used, these very expensive fuel cells. So basically they have massively reduced the price of fuel cells in this one single breakthrough. And, you know, that's what nanotechnology does, whether it's nanosolar, whether it's fuel cell, whether it's some other cool nano thing we haven't thought of. I'll give you one more example. A guy named Daniel Nocera, N-O-C-E-R-A, at MIT, has figured out that the way that the electrolysis works in plants, the enzymes for electrolysis are constantly breaking down in plants, for splitting the water into the hydrogen and oxygen, but they're constantly being reformed within the cytosol of the plant. So the plants don't need these hard enzymes that require these high energy activation energies. They just do it through intelligence. They have this incredibly complex kind of chemical intelligence that involves self-reassembly of the enzyme that gets broken in the process of catalysis. And so he's trying to figure out how to do this in a nanotechnology environment. And that, again, could totally disrupt our planet and push us into a hydrogen economy so much faster, because we're going to figure out how biology does it. We're going to take it into the nanotech space. And so I think if we say any one thing like solar is going to take over, we're making a bet, and it's great to make those bets, and we need to make them. But, the reality is there's five, six easy basic technologies like this that are all competitors right now. And they're all making progress, and they're all doing it in the nanotech space. And so I think, we're very comfortably on this curve of going to inner space to do more in outer space. We're doing more better with less, because we live in a particular universe. The physics of our universe allows that to happen. And we're starting to recognize that. We still aren't putting nearly as much money into nanotech as we should. Back to your issue of nuclear power and Brian Wong, I guess you said, it's quite possible we're going to be able to transmute the waste and actually disassemble it. And we might get what are called disassemblers, molecular disassemblers or atomic transmuters much, much earlier than we get assemblers. That could happen, much sooner. And so that would be one of the great ways to increase the possibility of of nuclear power. Again, once we've solved the proliferation issue, which I think is 10 times worse, but still, it's showing that all of these problems are cleaning themselves up, and it's just a question of which ones do we do first, and it's really mostly a political choice. And I think the more intelligence we have about these curves that Ray mentioned to you, you know, the solar improvement in solar and the tunnel boring doubling every 3 years, like I said, the more we understand these curves, the better choice we make. And the name of those curves for your listeners are called FPMs or TPMs, technology productivity metrics or functional productivity metrics, FPMs. And there's people who study them, the whole group of people who study this stuff. And we have an organization, a scholarly research community called Evo Devo Universe, and we're networking in all the people who study FPMs and TPMs, because that stuff all looks very developmental to me.
We'll be sure and link that group, as well as the Acceleration Studies Foundation and the Global Foresight Wiki, on the show notes.
Let's talk a little bit about how convergence and acceleration are related. Last week, Ray Kurzweil explained to our audience how acceleration of computational capacity leads to emergence of greater than human intelligence at some point in the future. I think, though, that implicit in that is a whole lot of convergence that he's got built into his model, although he doesn't mention it all that as much as acceleration, that convergence is a big part of what he's thinking about. Do we talk about it as two separate things, or is it one thing that basically one trend with two ways of looking at one trend?
No, I think you're right on. I think they are two separate things, and you know, one of the ideas, one of the names that was toyed around with the Singularity University that Ray started and that I'm an advisor to, was Convergence University, because convergence is such a fundamental concept. What things are coming together, and when are they coming together? And a lot of that has to do with the rates of growth of the various technologies. So I'll give you a couple of stories. One is the electromagnetic car suspension system that Amar Bose created, the guy who did Bose conduction, Bose quiet comfort headphones, and Bose acoustic wave radio speakers. And basically, I think in the 80s, he figured out that electromagnetic suspension is going to be way better than shocks and spring and air shocks, but that we didn't have the technology. But the rate at which the actuators, the TPM curves for the actuators, and we didn't have the processing power. We didn't have computers that were fast enough to do the reactions and the calculations. And we also didn't have sensors that were cheap enough to put on the car tires. But all of those things had TPM curves, and he could see them all converging at some point in the future. So he took one PhD, just one of his PhDs, and he put them on this project, I think half-time at first and then full-time later. And by the mid-1990s, he had it. He had a system, and if you go to, I believe, it's one of the 1998 Popular Mechanics cover stories for the Bose electromagnetic suspension. Beautiful article. There's also some nice videos on the web. I think YouTube has some. For this suspension system, it's so amazing that car goes into a pothole and immediately pushes down the suspension and then pulls it up so fast that you don't feel it. You actually have to tune the suspension to actually feel speed bumps and to make sure you don't just drive over curbs, because you just drive right up curbs. So this suspension is incredible. And, you know, the next time you get sick in a car, can't read, can't do anything, and you think, couldn't this problem be solved? Well, yeah, it was solved in 98, and it was solved through convergence. And actually, Bose's system is still pretty expensive, and he hasn't found anybody who's willing to license it for the price that he wants. And I think the cost of manufacture is still a little high. And so it doesn't go off patent until, I believe, another 6 years. So there's still another 6 years where we'd have a chance, primary patents, if I remember correctly, you have a chance to see a Bose version of this suspension in maybe a Lexus or whatever. But eventually, fortunately, the way the patent system works, it'll become public domain if he doesn't do anything with it. And we will be able to completely go to a new level of kind of productivity in our cars. And if we have somebody else driving us, you know, we're halfway to robocars, right? If we have taxi or shuttle systems cheap enough, which I think is one of those really interesting things that might happen in the next 10, 15 years, then, you know, you're just going to want to, you know, call up your taxi, your shuttle, and get in it and do, you know, anything that you want and be completely productive and connected, you know, 30 years before robocars. And that's because, basically, a guy named Amar Bose, this brilliant MIT physicist, realized that these convergence technologies were coming. He made the bet, and he developed the system. And then, of course, getting it into the cars is a whole other issue. But so convergence is something that happens. It's real. And if we recognize what things are coming first and what things have to happen before other things can happen, we can get out of what we call flying car futures. And I'm going to give you an example. You know, a flying car future is, as you probably heard many of the futurists, you know, one of the great quips that you give to a futurist is, you know, where's my flying car, future boy? You know?
Actually, I want to know how we get into a flying car future, okay? But maybe that's a different discussion for a different day.
No, it's not. It's a great quip because a flying car future is basically the idea where you predict a flying car, but you don't recognize that you have to have automated highways first.
Right.
Automated highways stack ahead in the convergence hierarchy for flying cars. So if you think automated highways are coming in 2030, well, then you can have flying cars after 2030, but you can't have them beforehand. And the reason you can't is because flying cars have to have an automated GPS navigation system in the car, not centralized, but in the car in case of any kind of centralized failure. You can't have that in the flying car in this case. And you can't have that complex three-dimensional kind of pattern recognition solving before you have it on two dimensions in roads. And when you have robocars, and of course the first ones that are going to come are going to be things that are going to be like auto park. You're going to get out in front of your big box store, and it'll drive at some governed rate of like 5 miles an hour or less, and it'll park your car, and it'll get it for you when you're in the line, so it's ready when you get out, right? And there's going to be dedicated lanes and HOV lanes for these things for at least 10 years before they're going to be widely deployed. And you can't have you have to have all that stuff first before you could even think about having a three-dimensional, super fast pattern recognizing automated navigation system in your flying car, which then would allow these things to be put in the air in any significant number. And of course, you got to have the lawyers deal with all the liability, blah 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 blah. So yes, they can come, but do they get outcompeted by more practical technologies earlier? They sure do. So they come only after the convergence has reached, after the timing is right for them. And I can give you actually four examples of futures that are talked about by a lot of people, a lot of futurists, a lot of colleagues of mine, that I think are very wishful futures for the near term. They're not going to be convergent at all for the near term.
Okay, go. List them off. How many of our world transform topics? I wonder is this going to take out of the equation? Go ahead. Let's hear them.
Well, I would say first the four that I'd like to just put on the table are human genetic modification and gene therapy. I think that longevity and aging, super longevity and aging, neuropharmacology, and brain machine interfaces and implants. And I think those are all important technologies, but they're all going to do vastly less than many of my futurist colleagues think that they will over the next 10 to 20 years. And it's primarily because of these convergence issues. Other things are going to beat them to the punch. And the things that are going to beat them to the punch are, for me, nanotechnology, just basic conservative nanotechnology. We're not talking about Dracula's engines of creation here. We're just talking about material science and the things you can do in the space of the small, which was certainly a key part of what Drexler said, but it's not his whole vision, right?
Right.
The second one is collective and individual intelligence amplification. The things that the web is going to become and the metaverse, basically the global metaverse of virtual worlds and mirror worlds and augmented reality and life logging, all that. And then artificial intelligence and computational neurobiology, what we're going to be able to do in these biologically inspired machines, increasingly evolutionary, increasingly creative, biologically inspired machines. And all three of those technologies are on very strong acceleration curves. They've always been on them. The first four that I mentioned, they aren't. They're a different class of thing. They're going into a human, which is actually very built from the bottom up, for long periods of time, over long periods of time, very highly tuned system, and we're going in top-down, tinkering with it. Most of the stuff that we do is not going to work. The social blocks, the complexity blocks are going to be very high, both of them. And the time it's going to take, most importantly, to make something significant in each of those spaces is so long by comparison to the other technology classes that you're not going to see the convergences that you think until after you have general AI. And once you have general AI, the much more interesting question, as all of us singularity folks think, is what's that going to do? And how are you going to make sure that is basically just an extension of you, you know, keeping your values paramount? And I think there's lots of good ideas for how you can do that, how you can create what AAAI calls safe learning agents as these systems get more and more complex world models encoded in them that are truly an extension of you. They're a cyber twin. They're basically a digital extension of you. And that, I believe, will be the politically preferred path for the development of those technologies. Meanwhile, you know, for human genetic modification, for example, if you read books like Greg Stock's Redesigning Humans or Ramez Nam's More Than Human or Joel Groh's Radical Evolution, you know, these folks are my friends, but I think they are overselling what can happen in that space significantly in the short term, not in the longer term, but in the short term, in the next 30 years being the short term. So a book like Denise Caruso's Intervention, The Real Risks of Genetic Engineering and Biotech, or Pete Shank's Human Genetic Engineering, A Guide for Progressives, you know, these books really show you what the culture is going to do with these technologies. They're going to just slow them all down. They're going to say, these things are complicated, and there's lots of body identity and in-group ethics questions for these things. We're going to slow them down, except to where they can cure a particular disease, and it's very clear. And will there be a magic bullet? Will there be a particular gene therapy that's going to let you create, you know, a 10 times smarter human? I don't think so. I think evolution's already tried most of those experiments, almost all of them. There isn't anything simple like that. What's going to happen is going to have to happen and be very complex. I think humans are, we talked about those S-curves of complexity.
Right.
Really interesting circumstantial evidence that humans are at the top of an S-curve of what they can do with their brains. Yes, they can kick it up a little bit, but by and large, we're a long ways away from those first replicating cells. We've got a whole lot of legacy code in us. The more legacy code you get, the less flexibility you have for making something that's significantly new, unless you're going to redo it in a new substrate the way the technologists are doing, right?
All right.
Okay, well, that does it for the first half of our interview with John Smart. We'll, as I said, we'll be picking that up next week, and we'll get into we'll go beyond the topics of acceleration and convergence. We'll get into talking about where this is all taking us. We'll start looking at this issue of human destiny, which is kind of the, I don't know, almost over the top final piece of the world transform that we decided we would spend some time on this program. I'm glad we didn't try to rush that all and try to fit it into one show. It seems like it's nice to kind of build up to it, don't you think, Stephen?
Absolutely. It's been a nice slow build up to it.
Yeah, well, certainly over the past few weeks, but even in the conversation with John, we get to cover a lot of different pieces, and it's great to get his perspective on certain things. Just there towards the end when we're talking about his view that you're probably not going to have a lot of radical acceleration with the human machinery itself, which kind of flies in the face of what a lot of futurists, even as he mentioned, good friends of his tend to think is a likely scenario. What do you think? What do you make of that?
Well, you know, truthfully, I have no way of knowing, but I thought it was very interesting the way you put it. We have lots of legacy code in our genetic makeup that we may not be able to get past easily. And so it might be that, you know, AI leapfrogs and is able to rush past us before we can turn around and actually help ourselves make the leap. So I think that's interesting. So I guess it makes the question of friendly artificial intelligence even more crucial, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I don't want to give away too much spoiler warning for next week, but definitely we'll spend some time talking about how a friendly artificial intelligence might emerge. Very different model for that than anything that that we've explored on the program up to this point. John takes a very different different approach to that, although you end up with a singularity and you end up with a friendly artificial intelligence. The path that we take to get there is going to be a little bit different than what we might have heard from Ray Kurzweil or what we might have talked about with our friends from the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. Another thing that caught my attention as I was listening to this is probably the third or fourth time that I've listened to this interview, is John gets into some technologies that you don't hear much about elsewhere in the accelerating change or transhumanist circles. And I'm thinking particularly of when he starts talking about tunneling and boring technology. You know, nobody else talks about that. And the potential significance of that is really, really tremendous when you observe that technology is on this accelerating curve, that it's on this exponential curve of how much of it we can do and how much of it we are doing. What's interesting about that one is I think we might find ourselves in this world where we've suddenly got tunnels going everywhere, and we don't even know how that happened, because it will have just more or less snuck up on us.
Absolutely. So, I mean, yeah, he's got some different ideas about that. And, you know, in the chat room, we had several folks basically say, you know, we sure would like some of these guests to give a more fleshed out view of what the future would look like. And John Smart kind of gets into that, some of the nuts and bolts of it in this interview, and I appreciated that.
Absolutely. Yeah, it makes for some fun stuff. I was just following a discussion in the chat. Anthony, you missed the first half of an interview with John Smart. So for anyone who's joining us late, we spoke with John Smart in two parts, and we'll be playing part two next week. Speaking of the chat room, I believe we've got our chat host Michael Darling with us on the line.
I'm here.
We failed to introduce you earlier, so apologize for not including you. Any observations on your end from what you've heard from John, or any interesting tidbits out of the chat room so far this evening?
Well, plenty of interesting bits in the chat. Well, let me say this about John Smart, and it could just be my own subjective reaction based on hearing this interview right now for the first time, and I'm tired, and I made the questionable judgment of attending a presentation at Invitation earlier tonight, hosted by the American Association of Retired People, talking about something else, and it kind of sucked the life out of me. But that guy is either wicked smart, or I just couldn't keep up, man. That guy was great.
Yeah. Steve and I were talking about this before the show, actually. When we had him on the phone, it's almost like you have to take a breather once in a while. He has so many ideas, and there's a coherence to it that makes the whole thing kind of exhausting, because most of us, when we go out on a tangent, we never find our way back. But when he goes off on a tangent, it's because he needs to go get something, then he's going to take you back to where you were. And it actually is it's great fun to listen to him. It's great fun to talk to him, and kind of challenging.
I like the way he does it so calmly. It's like he's been there before. He's putting the paddle in the water. He's going to pull. The boat's going to move a little bit. He's going to put the paddle in the water again and pull again. And the boat's going to move a little bit more, and he just keeps going. I was totally digging on it, but I was like, yeah, am I really keeping up or not? I don't know.
Well, just do what I did. Listen multiple times. That helps.
Yeah, that's why we make these programs available via archives, so we can all really get to know them. In fact, that's why we've made this whole 10-part series available to everyone in the world, basically, who needs to learn about how our world is being transformed. So let's talk a little bit about the two topics that we got into: acceleration and convergence. And I already observed that John brought us some acceleration that maybe we wouldn't have thought about talking to anyone else when you get into things like tunneling. What do you guys think about the relationship between those two things? I have in some ways it's almost like they're the two sides of the same coin, but John seems to think they're that you don't want to get too far down that road, that there really is something very distinct going on between the two of them.
Well, I have a sort of a mental conception of how they interact that I've called Spock's chessboard. The
original series Star Trek. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you had a three-dimensional chessboard, and you have multiple boards that you're playing on, and everything. Well, you remember the rice analogy, where you put one grain of rice on the first, and then you double it to two grains of rice on the second square, and so on and so forth. Well, you know, about 32 squares into it, you've got more rice than the world's ever produced.
Right.
Well,
actually, Ray Kurzweil took us through that last week.
Yeah, just last week.
Yeah.
And so, the thing though is that we're not just playing on one chessboard here. We've got multiple chessboards. We're playing three-dimensional chess, and we're seeing this rice analogy play out in multiple fields. So we've got the rice analogy working for us in AI, and in nanotech, and they're all interacting with one another. You know, when you see Spock play Kirk, you know, he's usually beating him, and he's moving pieces from one board down onto another, and so you obviously got to keep up with what's going on all boards. Well, that makes it obviously very hard if that's what we're doing with and that's the future we're looking at. Obviously, predicting becomes a dangerous pastime, doesn't it?
Absolutely, but the interactions between what's happening on the different boards, I mean, that's really where the convergence comes in. I think that's a great analogy, actually, when you talk about the exponential progression of the chessboard and the multiple levels of the tri-level three-dimensional chess that they used to play in on the old Star Trek. I think that really does sort of capture something. And even in the flying car example, we kind of got into that, and it's interesting that that John makes the case that you're going to have automated highways before you have flying cars. You're going to have to have solved a number of those problems prior to launching cars into the sky. You'll have solved them in two dimensions before you solve them in three dimensions. So that's almost another example of the same thing. And one of the things that was interesting about that was, I don't know if you mentioned it this week or if we get into it next week, but he talked about the relationship between this tunneling technology and the automation of highways, that the kind of underground tunnel tube highways will actually make it a lot easier to automate them. So there actually are these interesting relationships between seemingly unrelated technological developments, all of which are occurring according to this on this accelerated curve.
Absolutely. Well, do we have time to throw out some of our own predictions before we have to finish the show up?
Hey, if you've got some predictions, I'd like to hear them.
All right. Well, I'm just going to throw these out, and the problem with throwing these out, obviously, is that we don't know the order of, because often we don't know what the prerequisite technologies are, but I mean, it just seems like these are some obvious things that we're going to be seeing in the next few years. Well, I think we're going to see the first generation of life extension technology. I'm on record saying we're going to see that by 2014, which is just right around the corner. And what I'm talking about is the first treatments, whether you call them life extension technology treatments or not, that actually do have the effect of making our lives longer. So I'd say that's right around the corner. And then post 2015, according to John Smart, we start seeing AI technology that's smarter and more flexible. I differ with John Smart. I'm a little more optimistic about what we can do for our own brains. I believe that we'll be able to make ourselves significantly smarter about the same time. Robo-cars, then robo-aircraft would follow that, and energy that's cheap and abundant, and that cannot be held hostage by any one group of people. I think that would come to us by way of solar, I would think, and virtual reality that's as real life, but is infinitely configurable. Meanwhile, in this reality, we get richer, and thanks primarily to rapid prototypers and nanofactories after that. So, not a bad future.
I'm liking the way it sounds, Stephen. I got to tell you, you've lined up a pretty sweet future for us. Now, yeah, as I'm listening to you rattle off your list, there are some differences between what you're predicting and what we might have heard from Ray Kurzweil last week, or what we might have heard from John Smart this week or next week. And in fact, it's not just the rapid expansion of brain capability, I think, that John would argue with, but also the life extension technology is something he would say that we probably won't make significant leaps with that, just because that's something that evolution has already tried, and it's probably taken us about where it's going to get us. So, but obviously there's a lot of disagreement. Our second show in this series was with Aubrey de Grey, and different futurists have different views on how some of these individual pieces of the future are going to pan out.
Well, let me tell you why I would disagree on the whole life extension. We live as long as we need to, as far as evolution is concerned.
Right.
We live plenty long enough to reproduce, plenty long enough to see see our children grow old enough to reproduce themselves, and we even live long enough to see our grandkids and maybe even help out with their upbringing. So after that, I mean, why does nature care whether we die at that point? The fact of the matter is we care, and so we will try to do something about it. But I don't think that nature's really tried.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of reframing the question, and we'll have to spring that one on John next time we talk to him, because I think that question makes a lot of sense.
Ditto intelligence. Maybe there's really hasn't been a need for us to be any smarter than we are right now. So.
Oh no, there's been a need for that. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to disagree with you there.
Touché. I like that.
But that's a good outline of things to come. And looking forward to next week, we'll conclude our interview with John Smart, and we will actually take things well beyond the future that Stephen described into the future of sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers, and then quite a ways beyond that too. So if you're ready to take a trip into the distant future, and it's not necessarily distant in time, but distant just conceptually from where we are now, be sure and tune in next week, because that's exactly what we're going to be getting into. All right, Stephen, what do we got going on music-wise this evening?
The song is Wrong Thing Said the Right Way, and the band is Modern Science.
All right, Modern Science singing Wrong Things Said the Right Way.
That's right.
Story of my life right there. Okay. All right. Well, Stephen, thanks for putting that together. Michael, thanks to you and to all our friends in the chat room. For everyone listening live and for everyone listening to us via MP3, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. Be sure and join us next week as we conclude The World Transformed with the final part of Part 10. And until then, live to see it.